Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Natalia Shenko and I'm a neurologist and board member of the European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome and the Child Neurology Panel member of the European Academy of Neurology. Today, we have a pleasure to welcome two great experts to our podcast, which is a part of the podcast series, Are Children Small Adults? And in today's episode, we will talk about similarities and differences in movement disorders in children and adults. My guests today are Dr. Tammy Hedderly and Professor Alexander Munchow. Dr. Hedderly is a pediatric neurologist working at the King's College London and Evelina London Children's Hospital in London, UK. Professor Alexander Munchow is a neurologist specialized in systems motor science and movement disorders and director of Institute of Systems Motor Science, University Medical Center, Schleswig-Holstein, University of Lübeck in Germany. Welcome, Dr. Hedderly and Professor Munchow, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Yes, it's an interesting topic too. Thank you.
Yes. So yeah, let's just start. And first I wanted to ask Dr. Hedderly, what are the most common movement disorders in children? Can you maybe highlight for us?
Yes. I mean, I think as we work together in the European Society, and you will know too that one of the commonest presentations that we see in the pediatric neurology movement clinic is tic disorder or Tourette's. And we work with a high number actually of families. And I'm really interested to talk to Alexandra about the concept of how tics differ in children to adults, because we tend to transition children who present usually between the ages of around 5 onwards, but usually peaking around 10 to 12, who then often gradually improve. But we transition the children around 16 to 18. So it's very interesting to hear from Alexandra about his experience with the adults with tic disorders. But that's one of the commonest.
Yes, we will definitely talk about this topic too and about the transition because, well, it's very relevant, I think, and there are significant differences in terms of the practices in different countries too. Yes, so in children, tics and probably stereotypies too are frequent. And how about adults? Is it the same, Alexander?
No, clearly not. So it depends, of course, on the age. So the older the population gets, the more you see people with Parkinsonism. And in the 30s and 40s, the majority of movement disorders is probably dystonia. And in children and adolescents, as Tammy already pointed out, it's tics and Tourette syndrome. So it varies. So the older you get, you're more Parkinsonistic you become. And the younger you are, the more likely you have tics. So you could say this is sort of a dichotomy in a way, but it's a sort of gradual transition.
So it seems that there are significant differences. It is also interesting to take a look into the course of movement disorders with onset in the childhood. So what is the usual course for these disorders like tics or stereotypies? Tammy?
I think I'd like to start with stereotypies because this is a great interest of mine. And we see, I think it's much more common than we know and think about, but in childhood. But very frequently, early onset stereotypies, they usually start under 1 year of age. And they're often seen as, you know, quirky, little funny, normal behaviours or movements. But sometimes children go on to get very stuck in their stereotypies. And sometimes if we're looking, for example, at some of the primaries, we use the term primary, but it's not very accurate because often stereotypies can be genetic. But if we look at the common stereotypies, they sometimes become more florid around the ages of 2, 3, 4. Now, what we expect at that point is that slowly between the ages of 5 onwards, they start to privatize. And often by 5, they're not a prominent feature of the child's movement presentation. But occasionally we see children who really sort of seem to enjoy the stereotypies. Obviously, the parents, it's not the case. They're often very worried about them. But the children carry on and become quite persistent. And in these children, they can go on to start school, even secondary school, sometimes at age 11, and they're doing very, very frequent complex motor stereotypies. And at that point, it becomes clear that for some children, they're starting to want to stop because of stigma or worries about being bullied. And children then often come to clinic and say, please, can you help me learn to control them? And we use a program called privatization and promotion of privatization. Now, interestingly, having watched lots of these children then become later teenagers and adults, the point of transition, we very commonly see that children can learn to privatize the movement. But we reported not that long ago that some of the children have associated intense imagery with those movements. And when they become teenagers, some, not all, I want to emphasize that it's not all, they become stuck in an intense imagery world or a daydreaming world. And that's been an interesting phenomenon to observe, because if that becomes compulsive, some of the people experiencing it have termed this maladaptive daydreaming. And this is a relatively recent concept that's come out and is linked to movement disorder, or movements. And it's really important for movement specialists to ask carefully about the presence of intense imagery or daydreaming.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. And I know that, Tammy, you're sort of, you know, specialized in this. And I think it's great that you highlighted this important clinical features that often, especially us adult neurologists, we forget about. Yes. And how about the course of tics, Alexander? Can you highlight, you know, how is the course of tics through the life? And then are there any factors that are associated with persistence into adulthood?
Yeah, yes, there are probably some factors, but we have not really understood this well. I mean, we see both children and adults with tics, and with all movement disorders. We have clinics in both in the pediatric department and in the neurology department. Therefore, we can follow these patients from childhood to sort of adolescence. I mean, as long as we live, actually, as long as we are in clinical practice. And what we see in tics typically is that they are much more variable at a younger age, so fluctuating more. The repertoire at a given time may be the same, but you know, it changes more across time, and it seems to be more fixed, not completely fixed in adults, but sort of more stable. The likelihood, I mean, you can never say in a given person your chances to get rid of the tics is 67% or something. It's only, you know, a matter of probability. And if you look very closely in those who had tics in the past, you very often find tics, although they feel that they don't have tics anymore. So it's a matter of symptomatology and self-perception, and B, objective assessment of tics. But overall, you could say that there is a great chance that the tics become much less when you get older, so after puberty, or completely subside. I mean, to an extent where the patient or the people are not really bothered by this anymore. It's about 80% or so. This is what we usually say. And it's interesting to understand, but we have not understood it yet. Who will sort of lose the tics? Who will go into remission? Will not. I mean, there are some risk factors. For instance, having OCD is probably, so obsessive compulsive disorder, it makes it more likely that you have persistent tics in adulthood. And if you have an environment surrounding that is very focused on this, it's also more likely. For some reason, it seems to be less likely if you have ADHD, not very severe ADHD, but some ADHD, which may be related to it, attending to tics or not attending to tics. But overall, it's not completely clear. There are no biological markers telling us, you know, who will continue to have tics and who will go into remission.
Yeah, that's true that there are some studies, but exactly that it's a very, you know, I think that frequent question also of parents, right? And can you tell me what's going to happen to my child? But exactly, we don't really know yet. And it's also very interesting this is a small population, although me as coming from the field of adult neurology, we have these patients, that there are some adults with tic onset, well, and maybe not as frequent, but also stereotypies onset in the adulthood, right? What do we know about them? Why these exceptions occur? Because, you know, we just discussed that, yeah, basically this is usually a movement disorder that starts in the childhood, but not always. Yeah, maybe also Alexander is an adult neurologist.
Well, I can start. I mean, the first question is, did they really start in adulthood or have they started earlier, but people have not noticed? I mean, unless you have spoken to teachers and relatives and the family who observed the given person sort of 40 years ago, you can never be certain. This is point one. And the second point is, if there's really sort of a very convincingly shown that there is an adult onset tic disorder, then of course the question is, is it a typical classical tic belonging to the Tourette spectrum, or is it the first sign of another disease? I mean, there are some rare diseases, including neuroacanthocytosis, as an example, where you have onset of facial tics, mouth tics, and so on, that herald sort of chronic progressive neurodegenerative disease. This is very rare, but it can happen. And also, this can happen in Huntington's disease, but typically these are not the first signs. But this is to be considered. And then, of course, is it, which is much more likely, is it a functional disorder that resembles tic? Is it tic-like behavior? And this has to be viewed against the background of someone who had tics in the past, perhaps, not very noticeable, but then later develops, you know, functional movement disorder that resemble the tics that occurred previously. So again, this is a common scenario, and therefore, because it's clinically relevant, one has to consider functional disorders then.
I don't know, Tammy, do you want to add something, or?
Only that I agree with everything Alexander said. It's very interesting. I think when you see this kind of later onset, sudden presentation in teenagers of a very florid tic disorder, then what we're finding, sometimes these children have undiagnosed neurodevelopmental condition. They may have autism spectrum traits that haven't been identified, and they're actually presenting with more of a functional tic disorder. But it is interesting how often some of these children have simple motor tics that are very minor and haven't really been noticed in their background when you ask that question. So there seems to be a vulnerability to functional tic disorder that includes the presence of unrecognized simple motor tics in the past or phonic tics in the past. So probably Tourette neurogenetic underpinnings, but without a previous presentation of classical Tourette. But it's there in the background. So I think it's going to turn out to be quite complex when we do get the biomarkers and we get a little bit more knowledge around the FTLB, the functional tic-like behaviour. It's probably going to be more complicated. I wouldn't be, well, I think already we would all agree, I would imagine, that the sort of overlap with things like autism spectrum and neurodevelopmental conditions is there in the background sometimes.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's true that, you know, we are learning that that basically this overlap between tics and functional tic-like behaviors is much more frequent than we thought before, and especially due to the pandemic and, you know, that this surge in functional tic-like behaviors. So we talked about tics and a little bit also about stereotypies. How about dystonia and Parkinsonism? What are the differences between children and adults in this regard? Yeah, maybe who wants to start? Maybe Alexander again?
Well, I would say, first of all, if the child develops dystonia, then the likelihood that this is going to be a complicated scenario or a severe disease is much higher than in adults, so generally. So you much more often see neurometabolic diseases or degenerative diseases compared to adults. And then also the clinical cause is generally different. There's, a higher probability for dystonia to spread, to generalize in children and adolescents compared to adults. And in adults, it's more focal or segmental. And these are sort of two rules of thumb that need to be considered. So in children, this is the consequence. It's usually necessary to thoroughly assess them as regards the underlying cause. Now it's mainly genetic, of course, and not so much neurometabolic investigations and so on. And in adults, there's a less likely chance to find anything. And it's not really necessary because usually the cause is pretty benign. These are sort of different worlds. I mean, the sign per se is very similar, but the meaning of the sign dystonia in children and adults is different.
Tammy, do you have anything to add regarding the dystonia, maybe first?
Well, I just would agree that although rarer presentation than those, the more benign common pediatric movement sorts, when it does occur, as Alexander's saying, it's often very complex and severe, and the management is very multi-system. So we're looking at management of, you know, dental complications and gastrointestinal complications, and ensuring the young person is well hydrated and well nourished. And you're often involving the neurodisability team, the complex motor disorder team, and you know, even deep brain stimulation and things when we identify particular types of genetic dystonias that are going to, you know, probably help be improved by this technique. So the management is often multidisciplinary, and the children can present with very severe pain and discomfort, which obviously we work very hard to prevent. And yes, the investigation can help guide prognosis, but sometimes you get, you know, we're getting new genes presenting over the each kind of few years that we practice, we get even more genes that where you think, oh, right, now we know this gene causes this type of presentation, maybe a florid onset career with dystonia. So we are getting better at recognizing phenotypes within the dystonias, you know, obviously with things like the location of the dystonia and the progression and whether they're rostrocaudal or where they start. But I would just agree that it's often complicated and difficult. But obviously, hopefully, as new therapies come and we look to the future, hoping for more development of science and gene therapy and things, and we hope for a better future for children with dystonia.
That's a great point, I think, to summarize these differences. And yeah, how about Parkinsonism? Is it a little bit similar? So that basically in children, usually it involves such complex, you know, phenotypes and usually genetics. And in adults, it's usually probably Parkinson's disease. Or anything you want to add about Parkinsonism?
I suppose from a pediatric perspective, only that you have to be astute to be aware that this, it does exist in childhood. So we teach, you know, pediatricians, and as pediatric neurologists, it can be difficult to identify Parkinsonism because we're not really expecting it. So you have to be aware that, you know, we do have things like rapid onset Parkinson's dystonia in early childhood, even in infancy, and we have movement disorders that are Parkinson's. And that, I suppose, once you're under a movement disorder pediatric neurologist or specialist, they would know that. But it can be tricky to identify in the combination or constellation, I should say, of other developmental difficulties or developmental delay or the presence of more complicated neurology. So identifying, for example, the mask-like face, the hypokinetic components in a child that's presenting predominantly with developmental delay can be tricky. And so being aware that it's important to identify, because it can be in part treatable as well, of course. So and you need to know, it can help guide those principles of investigation looking for etiology. So for example, the neurometabolic disorders and the genetic disorders that can present in this way.
Yeah, that's a great point. How about treatment approaches? Do we generally treat movement disorders differently in children and adults? Yes, this is a very broad topic. Maybe, yeah, let's first start with tics and stereotypies. Maybe Alexander, is it similar in children?
I would like to add in as regards Parkinson's in children, two points. Of course, there's this group of dopamine disorders, you know, like Segawa syndrome or tyrosine hydroxylase deficiency, that usually or can respond quite well to levodopa treatment. And if you overlook this, then you're running into big problems. And then there's also this group of patients with defined neurodegenerative diseases, including Huntington's disease, that may present not with chorea, but with Parkinsonism and dystonia. So unusual presentations of some rare diseases that in adulthood present in a different way need to be considered in children. And this is a sort of general theme that is often quite puzzling, that a given disease has a different presentation in childhood as compared to adulthood. And why that is often not completely understood, but it needs to be considered. And therefore, we have to consider different phenotypes in certain diseases. This is what I wanted to add to Parkinsonism.
Yeah, great. Yes, thank you very much. These are great points indeed. That often, especially that's true that myself, in this younger patients, exactly that in the Huntington disease, for example, you even as a teaching point for, I think, for example, residents, that's very important to remember that there is this variant where Parkinsonism is more predominant in the phenomenology than chorea. Thank you very much, really, for this. Coming to the treatment, so, are there any differences in treatment for children and adults with tics and stereotypies? Who wants to start? Maybe Tammy then?
Well, I think it's very interesting because I think treatments of, for example, tic disorders, we have some evidence base for some good treatments, things like cognitive therapy and CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and habit reversal, exposure response prevention. And we have good evidence for psychoeducation, which we usually start with. And then we have the pharmacological strategies, which probably there is a big difference here, because I think as a pediatric neurologist, I'm much more likely to prefer these other techniques, the psychological techniques and the psychoeducation techniques, before considering medication. In fact, I would say probably as few as 1 in 10 of our patients would be on medication. And I suspect that might be a bit different in the adult world, but we can come to that. I think the other thing that we haven't done very widely that we probably should investigate more is the idea of promotion of acceptance, the model of kind of accepting the tics and where possible, bigging up the self-esteem, educating around feeling positive about tics. And we have this a unique opportunity in early childhood when the tics first present, that it always surprised me. If we can meet children quite early and before their teens, and really promote acceptance model and embracing the tic personality and being happy about the tics and working very much on the anxiety around the tics or maybe the obsessive compulsive disorder treatments very early, if that's present, managing ADHD, for example, then I find that the tics themselves are less often the problem. But you have an opportunity to get in there early with that, working together with the young people and their families. I think if children present much later with very florid and difficult tics, so 13, 14 onwards, and they haven't had that intervention, sometimes it can be tricky to use the psychological approaches. And not always, but I mean, we obviously would try that first, but then we start to move sometimes to children who are very, very upset or annoyed by the tics or aggravated by the tics themselves or the movements. Or then we would move towards consideration of different tic pharmacological therapies. And depending on the personality, we would choose the medication based around probably associated co-occurring conditions. So if they were very ragey with the tics, we might consider aripiprazole. If it was someone who was having ADHD personality, and they had ADHD and they wanted, but they were more bothered by the tics than the ADHD, we might think about clonidine. And if someone had OCD that was driving the tics, we might be thinking of SSRI. But obviously that is very tailored towards the individual.
Yeah, these are all great points. And it's true that I think that we as an adult neurologist often forget about this acceptance. And, sometimes there is also, unfortunately, no time for this appropriate psychoeducation also with parents. And Alexander, I wanted to ask you, what is your experience in terms of the differences in terms of treatment of tics in children and adults, especially given, you know, these differences in medication, because I was also trained in Canada. And for example, there, I think that generally alpha agonists are more frequently used in children and in adults, neuroleptics. But I think that there are significant geographical differences in this term.
I would like to also underline what Tammy said. I think it's very important to very early on try to increase acceptance, particularly in families and also school and so on. And because if you do, and if you ask, you know, children the question, so if everybody was ticking, would it be a problem for you? And they often say, no, then this is not a problem. Or if you're alone on your own and there are some tics that bother you, then often they say no. Sometimes, of course, they do bother because they distract or they may be painful and so on. So there's no reason to romanticize it. but often it's actually not a big problem, as Tammy said. And therefore, I agree that acceptance is a very important point. And I could say that there are no principal differences between children and adults as regards treatment, but some of the medication seems to work less in adults. For instance, a tiapret, which is not used in many countries outside Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, I think. But this usually works quite well in children, but it doesn't really work in adults. And the alpha agonist treatment like ranfaxine or clonidine, I think is can be effective in children, but it doesn't have the same sort of effects as, for instance, aripiprazole. And aripiprazole can be used both in children and adults. So there are some subtle differences, but not principal differences. And with respect to behavioral treatment, I often meet adults who had tics for some time and who are particularly bothered by a or two or three tics. And for them, behavioral treatment is actually very helpful. Habit reversal, cognitive behavioral treatment, and so on. And in children, I often see that it's quite variable, fluctuating. And then sometimes it's not so easy to get a handle on the different types of tics. So I usually wait and see before I embark on or before I recommend behavioral treatment, because in some children, then after some time it subsides, or it's not a big problem anymore. So I think what I want to say is in adults it does have a meaning, or it can be useful, the behavioral treatment, just as in children, and it's always, as you also said, Tammy, also an individualized treatment. So it needs to be tailored to personal preferences and needs.
We do sometimes, interestingly, do a combination of treatments. So we presented this at the European conference, but we run something called a Tic Toolkit Group, mm-hmm. Children. And we don't put everybody into this, as you've said. You know, we choose children who opt for, say, management of one particular distressing tic or a few tics that can be discreet and which might benefit from a combined approach. But this tic toolkit is very well received, but part of the components of that seem to be children meeting each other and knowing, like you say, they're not the only people affected. They get some bonding from that. They get some, they fed back to us that they like meeting other children with tics in this setting. We do the therapy online now in the groups and sometimes in person groups, but this can be quite a nice approach. I suspect this is different to adults. I'm not sure if people are doing adult group therapy.
Not really. No, it's not really.
But it seems to be quite a nice component. And the parents also quite like, well, they report sometimes enjoying meeting other parents who are going through similar struggles. And we cover things like sleep. And for the children, we cover the co-occurring conditions, and then we cover like different strategies. And what we find sometimes is that, in fact, we have a peer mentor as well within one of our groups, where we have a young person who has Tourette's advising and being there to answer difficult questions. But also, we find the young people often giving each other tips, which is very beneficial.
Wow, thank you for highlighting all these fascinating points and, you know, different practices. I think it's very helpful also for people who wants to develop clinics in their home countries and to learn from you as an expert. Finally, let's talk about transition. What difficulties have you encountered related to this topic? Yeah, maybe let's start with Tammy. Like, what are the practices in terms of the transition of care for these patients with movement disorders, and are there any difficulties?
Well, it's a very, very good question. I think we're quite fortunate in our service. We have some nice connections with the adult neurologists who specialize in Tourette's. But I find probably one of the hardest things about transitioning from pediatric services to adult services is parents often report within the pediatric clinics, they feel very kind of they get the regular appointments. It's not so much driven by the person seeking the appointment and the patient initiated kind of access. I think we have obviously school liaison, we have a nurse specialist, we have the psychologists, and we are quite responsive to messaging and things. I guess in certain clinics, it's the resources. I don't really want to, it's obviously so different in different countries, and the model of care is very different in across the world. I mean, in England, we have the NHS, so it's not privately funded. This is government funded, and there's always going to be resource limitations. But challenges, well, I think it's that whole, when young people go to university and they start, it's that question, do you consider this to be a disability or not? And young people often come and say, what do we put on our forms? What do we declare? I usually respond to that saying, what difficulties do you have in day-to-day life? What support do you need in day-to-day life as an adult? Because we want young people to feel empowered. We want people to be accepting. We want people to live a normal life, as normal a life as possible. And we want to enable people. And there, my principles are all about enablement and not disablement. But I think this kind of then becomes a challenge, doesn't it, in different fields, because people have different views. I mean, the young people experiencing the tics, some people will opt because they need to for more support. And some people don't maybe claim enough support. And there's a very wide range, I find.
Yes, yes, yes. I guess it's very individual, right? Yes, Alexander, do you have anything to add about transition of care?
Yeah, I think it's very, very important and often very tricky. At Lübeck, we are lucky because we have a center for pediatric and adult movement disorders. So we have a smooth transition because people who see children and adolescents can then continue to see adults. So we don't lose them. So if they want, the children can continue to be looked after by our team. But then it's a different department. So when they are children, of course, it's the pediatric department. When they get older, it's the Center for Rare Diseases. Or we also have founded an institute for medical center for people with disability, which is sort of similar to the social pediatric centers in Germany. And there is multidisciplinary, multi-professional care available in these centers. We can then realize this transition from childhood to adulthood within the same team. And I think that this is very rewarding, is also very accepted. It's quite unusual in Germany and also, I think, in many other places. But I would strongly promote this because I think, like, GPs who may see children getting older and then becoming adults, and this is sort of a specialized GP type setup, and it's all surrounding expertise. So those centers who gain expertise in pediatric neurology, they need some input from adult neurology and vice versa. And if that is realized, so in given centers or also across centers, then I think this patients benefit most.
Yes, thank you again for these great points. And is there anything we want to mention at the end? Any take home messages for our listeners? Because we will wrap up now. I think it was a great, really pleasure to talk to you both, and you have two different perspectives, but at the end they're joined, and that was exactly the idea behind all this series of podcasts, to show that children are not just small adults, but at the end they will be adults. So it's important, this transition. Yeah, any take-home messages, Tammy, for our listeners?
Only that I think it's really great to work with you know, great adult colleagues, and we're very lucky in our community of movement disorders where I think we do work quite closely together, the pediatric and the adult side, because this is very important to just collaborate, make bonds, learn from each other. So thank you for the invite today.
Yeah, I completely agree. So joining forces, coming together, having joint conferences, this cooperation sort of cannot be overemphasized. And I think if we do that in the smaller or larger communities, then this is to really try to the benefit of our patients.
Great. I think that these are great points. And this is also an invitation for our adult colleagues to also join child neurology panel of the European Academy of Neurology. And you are, both of you are great examples of people who are helping and neurologists who are working with, you know, children and adults and transition of care. Thank you again for your time, your dedication, and everything you're doing for the also tic disorders, clinical care and research care. Me as a tic disorder expert, I feel very fortunate to know you both. And thank you for our listeners to listen to us. And yeah, have a nice day.
Thanks a lot for the initiative. Thank you. And take care. Bye-bye.
Nice to see you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.